Baseball Hall of Famer Frank Robinson has made several breakthroughs during his career. He was the first player to win both the American League and National League Most Valuable Player Award. In 1975, he became the first black to manage a major league team. The team was the Cleveland Indians. In 1983, when he was managing the San Francisco Giants, he was named Manager of the Year. Robinson has written a new autobiography titled Extra Innings. He opens it by explaining that he was never outspoken about injustices to minorities in baseball because outspoken blacks were considered troublemakers. He knew he eventually wanted to manage, and what owner would hire a troublemaker who's black? But now that Robinson is in management, he's become more outspoken about racism in baseball. And he's a founding member of the Baseball Network, a group of black former players trying to counteract the white old boys network. Several weeks ago, Robinson became the manager of the Baltimore Orioles. He was already working there as special assistant to the president of the team. It's an opportunity for him to manage again, and he's managing a team he used to play with, the team he says he liked playing for best. But he's inherited a team firmly entrenched in last place. I asked him if he has ambivalent feelings about the new job.
No, not at all, Terry. I knew when I took the job what the situation was. I thought I could come in and help this team turn itself around, and we're starting to play a little bit of better baseball, and I think before the season's over, we'll have a respectable season. And, you know, I didn't really want to come back to managing, but they asked me to, and I felt like I could help this ball club.
Do you have a long-term strategy of how to turn the team around?
No, I don't. I've talked it over with our general manager, Roland Heeman, and also our owner, Edward Bennett Williams, and the other people in the organization, my thoughts on what this ball club and this organization has to do, and that is I think we have to build through our farm system. In other words, start putting talented prospects into the farm system. When we make trades, we get some top prospects back to put into our farm system. If we can build a farm system back, I think we'll have a winning team at the major league level.
You've actually been very critical of the minor leagues for not giving the kind of training that they used to.
Well, yes, and it's not just the minor leagues. Maybe it's unfair to the minor leagues. I think it goes back farther than the minor leagues. I think it goes back to Little League, high school baseball, sandlot baseball. Well, in the old days, and I don't like to talk about them too much, you had ex-professional baseball players as coaches and just teachers to teach you how to play the game. They gave you the good, sound, fundamental baseball, and they gave you a good foundation. You knew how to play the game when you came into professional baseball, and it was just a matter then of polishing your skills. But now you're teaching at every level in baseball, and even in the major leagues, when players come to the major leagues, you're still teaching them how to play the game, and it's very difficult to do that and try to win.
When Al Campanis made his now infamous remark about blacks lacking the necessities to manage, you were, debating him on TV shows about that statement and so on. Do you think that the major leagues are being shamed at all into making sure that they hire more blacks into management positions?
Well, I don't think they're being shamed into it. I think finally, with the problem out in the open, Al Campanis making that statement that a lot of us had been saying for years the problem existed, and the people in baseball said it did not exist, and finally the closet door was opened by someone on the inside, and this dreadful secret had been exposed. I think baseball finally said, okay, we do have a problem, and we're going to do something about it, and they have set out to do something about it now.
Well, you said that his statement was exposing a dreadful secret that you already knew about. How, in what ways did you know of that kind of racist sentiment existing within management?
Well, you just look at it over the years since Jackie Robinson broke the barrier as a player. No one until 1975 was offered a job to manage a major league ball club. I mean, a minority or a black. And you can't tell me up until that time there was no other qualified blacks to manage in the major leagues. And since that time, it's only been two other blacks that were qualified to manage in the major leagues. I just can't believe that. And also, there hasn't been one general manager in the history of baseball to run a ball club. There's no ownership at all in baseball. There's no one at the level of head of scouting in the Major League Baseball club, and only one farm director. And I must retract that statement. I think the late Bill Lucas was a general manager for a short period of time at Atlanta. And Hank Aaron right now is the farm director at Atlanta.
I guess I
just can't buy that those few people are the only ones that have been qualified to hold those type of positions in baseball.
My guest is Baseball Hall of Famer Frank Robinson, now the manager of the Baltimore Orioles, and author of a new autobiography titled Extra Innings. Now, you were the first black manager in the majors. Did you go through a kind of credit to your race syndrome of having to of knowing that you were going to be the example, that everything you did was going to be an example of, well, can blacks manage or not? Do you know what I mean? That I think the first person in a situation like that is going to be looked at as an example, and it's quite a responsibility to have, and it could be very inhibiting.
Well, there's no doubt about it, Terry. I went through that when I was a manager of the Cleveland Indians. Just take, for example, opening day, and I put myself in the lineup, and I don't know why, but I was on deck as the second hitter in the lineup, and it had to be 50 cameramen standing there snapping my pitcher,
mm-hmm.
and I had to climb over them to try to get to the batter's box. And everything that I did that year was recorded and reported, and every move that I made, everyone was second-guessing, and if it didn't turn out right, they were saying I should have done something else. If it turned out right, you know, it was still, well, he might have been lucky doing that. Sure, I knew that, and I knew that I would be judged and other minorities would be judged by what I did and how I performed. But I couldn't worry about that. I just had to go out and do the best job I possibly could do. And if the players performed the way they were capable of performing, I knew that we would have a good year. And if they didn't, I knew we'd have a bad year. As simple as that.
You had a lot of difficult adjustments to make going from playing to managing. And you write in your book that one of the most difficult adjustments was actually learning to work with pitchers because you'd hated pitchers so much as a batter yourself.
Well, that's true. I think that's the most delicate part, I think, of managing, other than dealing with the press, is handling pitchers. And a lot of people think that other than an ex-pitcher, managers don't handle pitchers very well because they don't know how they think. They don't know how they really act. They don't know how they feel. But I think that's an art. It's a feel for your personnel. You get to know them, you know. What happens to them when they get out of sync, you know, what happens to them when they're on their game and when they start to lose it in the late innings. A lot of people want is it, a manager change pitchers in the middle of a ball game just by chance. No, it's not by chance. It's by feel, knowing that individual, what he does when he's starting to lose a little bit off his fastball or starting to lose his control. Each pitcher has his own little thing that tips you off by what he's starting to do in a ball game if he's starting to lose his stuff.
You certainly knew as a player what made for a good pitcher. How did you overcome your resistance to really working with pitchers once you got into management?
Well, I had to overcome it.
Right.
They were on my team, and I had to get the most out of them. And it wasn't easy at Cleveland. I was probably a little impatient with some pitchers and went to the bullpen a little quicker than I probably should have on different occasions. But when you have a good bullpen, and we did have a good bullpen in Cleveland, David LaRoche was there, Jim Kern was there, and I thought they were outstanding relief pitchers, and they did a good job for me. So in the 7th, 8th, and 9th inning, I didn't hesitate to go to the bullpen to bring them into the ballgame. Also, we didn't have, on our pitching staff, we didn't have pitchers that completed too many games. I had the ability at that time to complete too many games. So, you know, I went out and got them a little quicker than probably I normally would have.
When you're in baseball, you have to learn how to deal with being released or being fired. Now, you were released from the Giants and Indians and as manager. Did you have to learn how to keep your confidence after that?
Well, when I was fired from the Cleveland Indians in 1977, I was devastated. I was hurt. It really bothered me a lot. And the day that I was fired, I didn't want to talk to anyone. And I did talk to the players, and I talked to the press. I could handle that. But once I left the ballpark, I didn't want to accept any calls or anything like that. I didn't want to talk to my family, although they were around, and they understood that. So they just kind of stayed away from me for a couple of days. But I got my act back together and said, hey, this is part of baseball. This is life, and life goes on. And I wanted to stay in baseball, so I just said, if it happens, it happens. And 3 weeks after I was fired, I was back in baseball. The second time at San Francisco, it didn't hurt as bad. I just didn't like the way they went about it in the middle of the night, like 12:30 at night, after we had won a ball game and we're back. I was back in my hotel room, and the owner flew into town, into Atlanta, as a matter of fact, and fired me in the middle of the night. I didn't like the way that went about, but it didn't bother me. It didn't hurt me as badly as the first time.
You know, when you're a teammate, when you're a player, you have all these players who are on the same level you are, and there's a certain solidarity between the players. When you're a manager, you're alone in a way that you're not alone when you're a player. Is that something that you miss, that sense of, you know, being on the same level with the team?
Well, there's no doubt about it. You do miss that togetherness and that closeness and the friendship. And it's a shame, really, in a way, that the manager is looked upon as the bad guy. And he's off by himself. And this is really why it's so important to have a coaching staff that you feel very comfortable with, mm-hmm. and you enjoy being around you, because really those are the only people that you really have a chance to talk to and to let your inner feelings out and discuss things with, because the players are really, the coaches are the good guys. They will tell things to the coaches that they won't dare say to the manager, because I'm the one that take them out of the lineup. I'm the one that pinch hits for them. I'm the one that don't play them that day. I'm the one that goes out and take the starting pitcher out and bring a relief pitcher in. I'm the one that didn't bring the relief pitcher in that felt like he should be in the ball game. Those type of things. So I'm the bad guy. So it's you're kind of off in a little world by yourself. But also, you don't want to get too close to the players, because you're management and you're the one that have to make the decisions. And it's very difficult, if you become real close to the players, to make those decisions. You don't want those personal things to interfere with your decisions as far as the ball club is concerned. Yeah. So it is kind of lonely as far as the manager is concerned.
As a manager, what's your approach to confronting a player who you suspect is using drugs?
Well, that's a very touchy subject and situation, because I've never seen a player use drugs myself personally.
Mm-hmm.
But you only suspecting him of doing something, and there are ways to approach it, but you just cannot come right out. I don't feel like you can, and say, I know you're using drugs. You sit a player down and you talk to him about the evils of using drugs, the drawbacks of using drugs, and what it can do to an individual personally, and also what it can do to his performance on the field, and it may cost him his career and things like that. And hopefully you can get through to him to where if he does have a problem, he will seek help.
Okay, my guest is Frank Robinson, who is a Baseball Hall of Famer, now the manager of the Baltimore Orioles, and the author of a new autobiography titled Extra Innings. Let's talk a little bit about your career as a player, quite an illustrious career. Now, you say in your book that you really didn't know anything about racism until you entered baseball in 1953. Was that your first exposure to segregation?
Well, it certainly was. As I was growing up in Oakland, California, I certainly knew the difference in the color of my skin and some of my friends and neighbors and people lived in a neighborhood. But those things never interfered with the friendship and the relationship that I had with those people. And around my household, my mother, my brothers, color of other people's skins or racism or prejudice was never discussed. We treated everyone the same. And if I didn't like someone, it wasn't because of the color of their skin. And when I entered baseball and couldn't go to a movie in Ogden, Utah because of the color of my skin, I was really hurt very badly. And that was the first time I'd really been away from home for any length of time. And also, you know, the area I had to live in, I had to live in the black area of the city. So that really bothered me. And the next year, it wasn't any better. I started in Tulsa, Oklahoma for 8 ball games, and I wound up in Columbia, South Carolina. And we had bus trips and things like that, and it wasn't much better at all, where you had to sit on the bus while the other players went into a restaurant to eat. And arrived at a city, you had to sit on the bus and wait for a cab to come from the black section of town to pick you up and take you back over there to go to the YMCA or private home to stay. So it was very, very hard on a young man from California that didn't grow up with those type of feelings, didn't really know anything about that, to start out in baseball and find out about those things.
Did you get any kind of support from management?
No, none
Moral
whatsoever.
Support. Mm-hmm.
Well, Not really. I guess they just felt like, hey, this, you signed on to do a job, and this is a job, and this is the conditions you have to play in. Mm-hmm. So go out and do your job.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your playing, but first we're going to take a short break. Frank Robinson is my guest, Baseball Hall of Famer, manager of the Baltimore Orioles, and author of the new autobiography, Extra Innings. We'll be back. This is Fresh Air. Baseball Hall of Famer Frank Robinson is my guest. In the majors, you developed a reputation for being a very aggressive player. One of the things you became known for was sliding into second with your spikes up and frequently knocking into the second baseman. What were your guidelines there? You say your ethic was win any way you can win within the rules. What were your kind of guidelines in your own head about how to slide into second and to be intimidating but not to take that too far?
Well, Terry, I'll tell you, I never slid into a base to intentionally hurt anyone, but I had a job to do, and that my job was to try to break up the double play any way I possibly could do that. That's the way I was taught how to play the game when I was a kid, and that's the way I played the game throughout my playing career. And the idea was to go in there any way you possibly could. I never really, in my heart, went in with my spikes what I call high. Mm-hmm. But as people might know from the old days, as we say it, old shoes, baseball shoes in those days had metal spikes on the bottom of them. And when I slid into the base, naturally those spikes were facing the infielder, the shortstop or the second baseman or whoever. And if it happened to come in contact with their body, the possibility of them being cut was there. And it did happen. And on occasions, it did happen. And just players thought that I was maybe a little vicious. But I was never vicious as far as my playing was concerned, as far as sliding to bases. You know, I was injured also with spikes. Sliding into second, I missed a shortstop. He went up in the air. He came down on my arm and gave me 30 stitches in my bicep. And the doctor said if it had been half an inch lower, my career would have been over. But I didn't worry about it. I just had it stitched up and came back in 10 days and played.
Well, if you ended up spiking a player as you were sliding into second, would there be a payback later in the game?
Well, the possibility was there. The next time I was up at home plate, the possibility of being hit in the ribs, hit in the head was there, but I never let that bother me. I went up to home plate and didn't worry about it. Also, the possibility the next time I was going down to second base, if the second baseman, the shortstop, got the ball in time before I had a chance to slide, the possibility they were going to try to stick one between my eyes. But I didn't worry about that either. That was all part of the game, and I knew that, and I knew the price that I might have to pay going into a base if that did happen.
Let's stay at home plate for a minute. You also used to crowd the plate a lot as a hitter. Explain the strategy of that, of standing really close to the plate when you're batting.
Well, I changed my stance when I came to the major leagues. I moved right up on top of the plate, and I bent over at the waist and just stuck my elbows out over the inner part of the plate. And the strategy in that was to take the outside part of the plate away from the pitchers. I thought, and I felt like, and I still do, that the pitchers in the major leagues was much smarter and able to get the ball where they wanted to much more so than they did in the minor leagues. And I didn't want to give them the outside part of the plate because that's the biggest part of the plate, and I thought they could more consistently make their pitches out there. So that's why I did that.
So it gives you certain advantages over the pitcher. On the other hand, it's a kind of dangerous position to take because you're more likely to get hit by a ball if you're that close to the plate.
No, it's no doubt about it. I was hit 198 times.
Is that a record?
It was for a while until Ron Hunt came along, and he upped the record to 250 times.
Wow.
And, now Don Baylor has it going is close to 300 times right now and counting. So it was quite a few in those days, and so now look at Don Baylor, been hit almost 300 times. It's mind-boggling, really. But, you know, that was all part of the game. I would be thrown at, knocked down, whatever, and you would get up and just do damage to the pitcher with the bat. And that's the only way I looked at it, I didn't really worry about it, as long as I didn't feel like a pitcher was throwing at my head intentionally.
What were your tricks for getting out of the way of the ball?
Recognizing the pitch right away, knowing that it's a fastball rather than a curveball. And certainly if a fastball is up and in, you better get down real quick. And we were taught to roll our front part of our body back towards the screen. In other words, you roll your front shoulder back and hopefully and pull tuck your head down and into your body to protect your head and face, so the ball would hit you in the meaty part of your back, so you wouldn't be hurt very seriously.
You have said that when a pitcher threw intentionally at a player on your team, that you would tell your pitcher to try to reciprocate in some way?
Well, at times, if I thought they were doing it intentionally because a hitter had been hot and had been hitting the ball pretty good against that pitcher or that ball club, I have at times early in my career as a manager said to our pitchers, I want you to hit this guy on the knee. I never said in the head or anything like that. I always made the target lower than that I thought maybe the pitcher might aim at. So I always said, hit this guy on the knee. But I can honestly say I can't remember any pitcher really going out there and doing that. I had some that tried to do it. They threw the ball back to the backstop to hit the screen. They threw the ball in the dirt and missed the player by 3 or 4 feet. But I can't really remember a pitcher really after I told him to do that going out there and doing it.
Let's get back to your ethic of win any way you can within the rules. Did you think of like telling a pitcher to to hit someone as being within the rules?
Well, I thought so. I think being hit is within the rules. That's all part of baseball and has been ever since baseball has been played. And what you do is you're saying, I'm protecting my own. The hitters are going up to home plate trying to score runs for the pitcher. And the only way our pitcher is going to win ball games is if we do score runs. And if the other team is taking advantage of the situation and throwing it out of hitters to try to make them a little gun-shy at the plate or hitting them to where they cannot stand up there and do their job with the bat, then he has to protect his teammates. And that's the only reason why, on occasions, that I asked my own pitchers to do that.
Frank Robinson is my guest, Hall of Famer and manager of the Baltimore Orioles, also author of the new autobiography, Extra Innings. Now, I think initially in the majors, you had the reputation of being an overly aggressive, maybe kind of mean player. And then I think the attitude toward you really changed and you started to really be, you know, very, very loved by fellow players. What changed in the way you were viewed by the people in the majors?
I think the only thing that changed in the way that I was viewed by players is that players got to know me. Either they became teammates of mine and got to know me in that respect, or they started to get a little closer to me by chatting with me about hitting when we had some spare time before a ball game and things like that. And they found out that Frank Robinson really wasn't a bad guy after all. I think a lot of people just made judgments on my character and me before they really got to know me.
You are now a Baseball Hall of Famer and manager. Are there any special advantages or problems that a star player like you faces when moving into a management position?
Well, I think everyone is, you put you under the microscope. They're always checking you out to see what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. And also, I think a lot of people think that just because you're not successful right away or you're not successful, that outstanding players cannot manage in the major leagues. And I think that's one of the things that I've been fighting for a long time. And I said, you know, name me one outstanding player that's been given a good team to manage, and no one can come up with a name, because most of the time when you hire an outstanding player, it's usually he's usually given a bad team because that team has failed. And you feel like if you name an outstanding player to manage that ball club, it was also attract improve the attendance, number one, and maybe the players will respond because of the respect they have for the player for what he has achieved in his career.
Is that the kind of position you feel in now?
Not as much as I did the first two times around, and everyone always thinks that Frank Robinson wants his players to play the way he played the game. That's another thing, and that couldn't be anything farther from the truth. No, I think with this ball club, it's a mature ball club to an extent, especially our top players. I've been around them for quite some time as a coach and as an executive, and they know me as an individual. They know me. They know what I did as a player. They didn't see me play because they weren't old enough. But I think it's a much better situation here than it was at San Francisco and Cleveland as far as that's concerned.
What are some of the things as a manager you keep in mind about what you learned as a player? In other words, things from the player's perspective that now you can keep in mind as a manager.
Well, I think the main thing is the way I want to be treated as a player. I think that is the most important thing. I try to treat the players under me as a manager the way I wanted to be treated as a player. And I think if you can do that, the players will respond for you and to you.
Is there a moment in your career that you think of as your greatest moment in baseball?
No. I had 21 years as a player, and I've coached on a number of years and been on a couple of winners. And I've managed, and I haven't been a winner yet as a manager, but I just cannot pick out one instance and say this is the greatest thing that happened to me. I think one of the things that really turned my career around was being traded to the Baltimore Orioles.
It's the team in your book that you describe as the only team when you were a player where the black players and the white players hung out together.
Well, that's true. At Cincinnati, I was treated very well at the ballpark and on the field and around the players when we were together on the road and everything like that. But once we were away from the ballpark, we didn't. The togetherness wasn't there. But at Baltimore, it was just a real great atmosphere and a real good feeling among the players from the time that I stepped on the field in Miami, Florida. It was the first spring training game that we had and the first in a squad game. First time I stepped on the field, that feeling was just there. It was like a family affair, and it was a togetherness and closeness among all the players. No one was treated any differently than anyone else.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your career as a player and a manager. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me on, Terry.
My guest has been Frank Robinson, Baseball Hall of Famer, who's now the manager of the Baltimore Orioles. He's the author of a new autobiography, which is titled Extra Innings, and is published by McGraw-Hill. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.